put your foot in it, people will forgive you," they replied. So it was that he found himself sitting behind a desk for the first time in his life, with a personal secretary at his disposal and a grandiose portrait of the founding father at some valiant battle hanging behind him. Pedro III García stared out the barred window of his luxurious office and could see only a small square of gray sky. His job was not a sinecure. He worked from 7 a.m. until late at night, and by the time he left work he was so tired that he was incapable of striking a single chord on his guitar, much less making love to Blanca with his accustomed passion. When they were able to arrange a meeting, surmounting all of Blanca's usual obstacles in addition to the new ones imposed by Pedro's job, they would find themselves more full of anguish than desire. They made love wearily, interrupted by the telephone and harried by time, of which there was never enough. Blanca stopped wearing her risque lingerie because she decided that it was an unnecessary provocation that made her look ridiculous. In the end, they met only so that they could sleep in each other's arms like a pair of grandparents and to hold friendly conversations about their daily problems and the serious matters that were shaking the country to its core. One day, Pedro III realized he had gone a whole month without making love, and that, what was even worse to him, neither of them had really wanted to. This shocked him. He knew there was no reason for him to be impotent at his age, and was forced to attribute it to the kind of life he was leading and the bachelor ways he had developed. He imagined that if he could lead a normal life with Blanca, one in which she would be waiting for him every evening in a peaceful home, everything would be different. He announced he would marry her once and for all, because he was fed up with furtive love and too old to continue living like this. Blanca gave him the same answer she had given him so many times before. "I have to think it over, my love," she said. She was sitting naked on Pedro III's narrow bed. He studied her dispassionately and saw that time was beginning to ravage her beauty. She was fatter and sadder, with hands deformed now by rheumatism, and the magnificent breasts that years earlier had kept him awake at night were slowly but surely approaching the broad lap of a matron firmly settled in her years. Still, he found her just as beautiful as he had when he was young, when they had made love in the reeds along the banks of the river at Tres Marias, and it was precisely this thought that made him regret that his exhaustion was stronger than his passion. "You've been thinking it over for almost half a century," he said. "That's long enough. It's now or never." Blanca was not surprised, for it was not the first time he had given her an ultimatum. Each time he broke off with one of his young mistresses and returned to her side, he demanded that she marry him in a desperate attempt to hang on to her love and find forgiveness. When he agreed to move out of the working-class neighborhood, where he had been happy for years, and to resettle in the middle-class apartment, he had said the same thing. "Either you marry me now, or we never see each other again." Blanca did not realize that this time Pedro III's mind was made up. They separated angrily. She got dressed, quickly gathering her clothes, which were strewn across the floor, and wrapped her hair into a bun that she moored to her head with a handful of hairpins she retrieved from the bed. Pedro III lit a cigarette and did not take his eyes off her while she dressed. Blanca finished putting on her shoes and waved goodbye to him from the doorway. She was sure that he would call her the next day for one of his spectacular reconciliations. Pedro III turned his face to the wall. A bitter grin had transformed his mouth into a single line. It would be 2 years before they met again. In the days that followed, Blanca waited for him to get in touch with her, according to their time-worn pattern. He had never failed her, not even when she had married and they had spent a year apart. Even then, it was he who had come looking for her. But after 3 days with no word from him, she began to be alarmed. She tossed and turned in her bed, tormented by an unrelenting case of insomnia. She doubled her dose of tranquilizers, took refuge once again in her migraines and neuralgias, and in an attempt to stay busy and not think, she stupefied herself by cooking hundreds of creche monsters in her kiln for Christmas. Still, she was unable to suppress her impatience. Finally, she called the ministry. A female voice replied that Compañero García was in a meeting and could not be interrupted. The next day, Blanca called again. She continued to call all the rest of that week until she realized she would never get through to him that way. She forced herself to swallow the enormous pride she had inherited from her father, put on her best dress and striptease garter belt, and set out to visit him at his apartment. Her key did not fit the lock, and she was obliged to ring the bell. The door was opened by a mustached giant with the eyes of a schoolgirl. "Compañero García isn't here," he said without asking her in. It was then she understood that she had lost him. She had a fleeting vision of her future, seeing herself in a vast desert where she was wasting away, devoting herself to tasks that used up her time. Without the only man she had ever loved, and far from the arms she had slept in since the long-gone days of her early childhood, she sat down on the stairs and burst into tears. The man with the mustache quietly shut the door. She told no one what had happened. Alba asked her about Pedro III, and she answered evasively, saying that he was extremely busy with his new job in the government. She continued giving her classes for young ladies of leisure and mongoloid children, and even began to teach ceramics in the shanty towns, where the women had organized to learn new trades, and, for the first time, she took an active role in the political and social life of the country. Organization was necessary, because the road to socialism quickly became a battlefield. While the people were celebrating their victory, letting their hair and beards grow, addressing each other as compañero, rescuing forgotten folklore and native crafts, and exercising their new power in lengthy meetings of workers where everyone spoke at once and never agreed on anything, the right was carrying out a series of strategic actions designed to tear the economy to shreds and discredit the government. They controlled the influential mass media and possessed nearly limitless financial resources, as well as the support of the gringos, who had allocated secret funds for the program of sabotage. Within a few months, the results could be seen. For the first time in their lives, people had enough money to cover their basic needs and to buy a few things they had always wanted. But now they were unable to do so because the stores were nearly empty. Shortages of goods, which was soon to be a collective nightmare, had begun. Women woke up at dawn to stand in endless lines where they could purchase an emaciated chicken, half a dozen diapers, or a roll of toilet paper. Shoe polish, needles, and coffee became luxury items to be gift-wrapped and given as presents for birthdays and other special occasions. The anxiety of scarcity had arrived. The country was swept with rumors about products supposedly going to disappear, and people bought anything they could, without thinking, as a precaution. They stood in line without even knowing what was being sold, just so they would not lose a chance to buy something, even if they did not need it. A new occupation was born. Professional line standers, who held other people's places for a reasonable sum. There were also peddlers of sweets, who took advantage of the lines to hawk their goods, and people who rented blankets for the long nighttime lines. The black market flourished. The police tried to restrain it, but it was like a plague that seeped in everywhere. And no matter how much they checked the trucks and stopped people carrying suspicious packages, they could not prevent it. Children made transactions in schoolyards. In the hysteria to get things, there were all sorts of confusions. People who had never smoked wound up paying an exorbitant sum for a pack of cigarettes, and those without children found themselves fighting over cans of baby formula. Spare parts for kitchens, for industrial machinery, and for cars disappeared from the market. Gasoline was rationed, and the lines of automobiles could last 2 days and a night, constricting the city like a gigantic motionless boa tanning itself in the sun. There was not enough time to stand in so many lines, and since office workers had to get around the city on foot or by bicycle, the streets filled with panting cyclists that looked like a frenzy of Dutchmen. This was the state of things when the Teamsters declared their strike. By the second week, it was clear that this was not a union matter, but a political one, and that the men had no intention of returning to work. The army wanted to take control because the produce was rotting in the fields, and there was nothing for housewives to buy in the markets. But the drivers had dismantled their engines, and it was impossible to move the thousands of trucks that were strewn along the highways like so many fossilized remains. The president appeared on television asking the people to be patient. He warned the country that the Teamsters were in the pay of the imperialists, and that they would stay out on strike indefinitely. People would be wise, he said, to plant their own vegetables in their yards and on their terraces, at least until another solution was found. Meanwhile, the people, who were accustomed to poverty and most of whom had never eaten chicken except at Christmas or on Independence Day, did not give up the euphoria of the first days of victory. They organized themselves as if for war, determined not to let the economic sabotage spoil what they had won. They continued celebrating in a festive spirit and singing that the people united would never be defeated, even though each time they sang, it sounded more out of tune, because divisiveness and hatred were inexorably growing. Like everyone else, Senator Threba also found his life changed. His enthusiasm for the struggle he had undertaken restored his former vigor and relieved some of the pain in his aching bones. He worked as he had in his heyday. He made numerous conspiratorial trips abroad and traveled the country tirelessly from north to south on planes, cars, and trains, on none of which were there now such things as first-class tickets. He endured the extravagant dinners with which his hosts received him in each city, town, and village he visited by pretending to have the appetite of a prisoner, despite the fact that his aging digestive tract was no longer up to such acrobatics. He lived in meetings. At first, his long democratic experience impeded his ability to set traps for the new government, but he soon gave up the idea of obstructing it by legal means and came to accept the fact that the only way to unseat it was by using illegal ones. He was the first to declare in public that only a military coup could halt the advance of Marxism, because people who had anxiously waited 50 years to be in power would not relinquish it because there was a chicken shortage. "Stop acting like a bunch of faggots and take out your guns," he shouted when there was talk of sabotage. He made no secret of his ideas. He broadcast them to the four winds, still dissatisfied. He went to the military school from time to time to throw corn at the cadets, shouting through the fence that they were all a bunch of chickens. He was forced to hire a pair of bodyguards to protect him from his own excesses. However, he often forgot that he had engaged them, and when he felt them spying on him, he would have a tantrum, insulting them and threatening them with his cane until he was practically choking. His heart was beating so hard. He was convinced that if anyone tried to assassinate him, these two stocky morons would be powerless to prevent it. But he trusted that their presence would at least scare off spontaneous detractors. He also tried to place his granddaughter under surveillance, for he thought that since she moved in a circle of communists, at any moment someone might mistreat her because of her relationship with him. But Alba would not hear of it. "A hired bully is the same as a confession of guilt. I have nothing to be afraid of," she said. He did not dare insist. He was tired of fighting with the members of his family. And besides, his granddaughter was the only person in the world with whom he could express tenderness, and who was able to make him laugh. Meanwhile, Blanca had organized a network for obtaining provisions through the black market and her contacts in the working-class neighborhood where she went to teach ceramics to the women. She had to work and worry for every bar of soap or bag of sugar she could find. Eventually, she developed a cunning she had not suspected in herself, managing to store all kinds of things in the empty rooms of the house, including some things that were downright useless, like the 2 barrels of soy sauce she bought from a Chinese immigrant. She sealed the windows, put padlocks on the doors, and wore the keys around her waist, not removing them even when she took a bath, because she distrusted everyone, including Jaime and her daughter, and not without reason. "You look like a jailer, Mama," Alba would say, alarmed at this mania for ensuring the future by embittering the present. Alba felt that if there was no meat, they should eat potatoes, and that if there were no shoes, they should wear sandals. But Blanca, horrified at her daughter's simplicity, held to the theory that whatever happened, one should not lower one standard of living, which she used to justify the time she spent in her smuggler's ploys. Actually, they had never lived so well since Clara's death, because for the first time since that date, there was someone in the house to see to domestic order and take charge of what went into the pots. Crates of food were delivered regularly from Tres Marias, and Blanca promptly hid them. The first time, almost everything rotted, and the stench issued forth from the locked rooms, spreading through the house and seeping out into the neighborhood. Jaime suggested to his sister that she either donate, trade, or sell any perishable items, but Blanca refused to share her treasures. Alba understood then that her mother, who up till then had seemed like the only sane person in the family, also had a streak of madness. Alba made a hole in the wall, through which she removed part of what Blanca stored. She learned to do it so carefully, stealing cupfuls of sugar, rice, and flour, breaking off pieces of cheese, and spilling open the sacks of dried fruit to make it look like the work of mice, that it took Blanca more than 4 months to suspect her. At that point, she made a written inventory of everything in her pantry and began to put a cross next to the things she removed for household use, convinced that the new system would bring the thief to light. But Alba took advantage of any carelessness on her mother's part to make new crosses on the list. In the end, Blanca was so confused she did not know if she had erred in her accounting, if they were eating 3 times more than she had calculated, or if it was true that there were still ghosts in that accursed mansion. The product of Alba's thefts wound up in the hands of Miguel, who distributed in poor neighborhoods and in factories, along with his revolutionary pamphlets calling on the people to join in an armed struggle to bring down the oligarchy. But no one paid any attention to him. They were convinced that since they had come to power through legal means, no one could take it away from them, at least not until the next presidential election. "They're fools. They don't realize that the right is arming itself," Miguel said to Alba. Alba believed him. She had seen enormous wooden crates unloaded in the courtyard of her house in the middle of the night, and their contents silently stored, under Trueba's orders, in another of the unused back rooms of the house. Like her mother, her grandfather put a padlock on the door and kept the key around his neck in the same suede pouch where he carried Clara's teeth. Alba told this to her uncle Jaime, who, having made peace with his father, had moved back into the house. "I'm almost certain that they're weapons," she confided. Jaime, who at that time was preoccupied and more or less continued to be until the day they killed him, could not believe it. But his niece was so insistent that he agreed to ask his father at the dinner table. The old man's answer removed any doubts. "In my house, I do as I see fit, and store as many boxes as I feel like. Don't stick your nose into my affairs," Senator Trueba thundered, slamming his fist on the table so that the glassware jumped, and stopping the discussion in its tracks. That night, Alba went to see her uncle in his tunnel of books and proposed that they apply the same system to his father's weapons as she had to her mother's provisions. And so they did. They spent the rest of the night boring a hole in the wall of the room adjacent to the arsenal, which they hid with a large wardrobe on one side and on the other with the forbidden boxes themselves. This entrance enabled them, armed with a hammer and a pair of pliers, to gain access to the room Trueba had shut. Alba, who already had experience in this line of work, suggested that they start with the boxes on the bottom. They found a military cache that left them open-mouthed, for they had never seen such perfect instruments of death. In the days that followed, they stole everything they could, leaving the empty boxes under the other ones after filling them with stones, so they would go unnoticed if anyone tried to lift them. Between them, they pulled out pistols, submachine guns, rifles, and hand grenades, which they hid in Jaime's room until Alba could take them in her cello case to a safer place. Senator Trueba saw his granddaughter walk by pulling the heavy case, never suspecting that the bullets he had worked so hard to bring across the border and into his house were rolling about in the velvet lining. Alba wanted to hand the confiscated weapons over to Miguel, but her uncle Jaime convinced her that Miguel was no less a terrorist than her grandfather, and that it would be better to get rid of them in such a way that they would not harm anyone. They discussed various alternatives, from throwing them in the river to burning them on a pyre, but finally decided that the most practical solution would be to bury them in plastic bags in a safe, secret location in case they were ever needed for a nobler cause. Senator Trueba was surprised to see his son and granddaughter planning an outing to the mountains, for neither Jaime nor Alba had participated in any sport since they left the English school and had never shown the slightest inclination for the discomforts of hiking in the Andes. One Saturday morning, they drove off in a borrowed jeep, supplied with a tent, a basket of food, and a mysterious suitcase that they had to carry between them because it was as heavy as a corpse. In it were the weapons they had stolen from the old man. They took off enthusiastically in the direction of the mountains, driving as far as they could, and then continuing on foot until they found a tranquil spot in the midst of that wind and cold-swept vegetation. There they dropped their gear and clumsily pitched their tent, dug holes, and buried the plastic bags, carefully indicating each spot with a little pile of stones. They spent the rest of the weekend trout fishing in the nearby river and roasting their catch on a fire of brambles, exploring the hills like children, and talking about the past. At night, they drank hot wine with cinnamon and sugar, and, huddled in their shawls, raised a toast to the face old Trueba would make when he discovered that he had been robbed, laughing until the tears rolled down their cheeks. "If you weren't my uncle, I'd marry you," Alba joked. "What about Miguel?" "He'd be my lover." Jaime did not think that was amusing, and the remainder of the trip he was withdrawn. That night they climbed into their sleeping bags, put out the paraffin lantern, and lay in silence. Alba fell asleep almost immediately, but Jaime, his eyes open in the darkness, saw the sun come up. He liked to say that Alba was a daughter to him, but that night he caught himself thinking that he wished he was neither her uncle nor her father, but Miguel. He thought about Amanda and regretted that she no longer moved him. And when he searched his memory for the last embers of their excessive passion, he could not find them. He had become a recluse. At first, he had been very close to Amanda because he had taken charge of her treatment and had seen her nearly every day. She had been in agony for several weeks until she was able to live without drugs. She also gave up cigarettes and alcohol and began to lead a healthy, orderly existence. She put on weight, cut her hair, made up her large eyes again, and went back to wearing her tinkling necklaces and bracelets in a pathetic attempt to remove the tarnished image of herself. She was in love. She went from depression to a state of permanent euphoria. Jaime was the focus of her obsession. As proof of her love, she offered him the enormous effort she had made to free herself from her numerous addictions. Jaime scarcely encouraged her, but he lacked the fortitude to reject her because he felt that the illusion of love might help in her recovery, although he knew that for the two of them, it was too late. All he did was try to maintain a certain distance, on the pretext of being a hopeless bachelor when it came to matters of the heart. He was satisfied with his furtive encounters, with an occasional willing nurse from the clinic, or his sad visits to brothels, which were enough to meet his most pressing needs in the rare free moments his work afforded him. Despite himself, however, he was involved in a relationship with Amanda that he had desperately wished for in his youth, but that no longer touched him deeply, and he felt incapable of sustaining. He was inspired only with compassion, but this was one of the strongest emotions he was capable of feeling. In a lifetime of living with misery and pain, his soul had not hardened. If anything, it was increasingly vulnerable to pity. The day Amanda threw her arms around his neck and told him that she loved him, he hugged her back mechanically and kissed her with a feigned passion so that she would not notice he did not desire her. He now found himself trapped in a demanding relationship at an age when he no longer saw himself capable of tumultuous love. "I'm no good at these things anymore," he would think after those exhausting sessions with Amanda, who, in order to charm him, resorted to the most extreme expressions of her love, leaving both of them undone. His relationship with Amanda and Alba's insistence often brought him in contact with Miguel. There was no way to avoid meeting him on certain occasions. Jaime did his best to seem indifferent, but in the end, Miguel captivated him. He had matured and was no longer an excitable youth, but his politics had not changed in the least. He still believed that it would be impossible to defeat the right without a violent revolution. Jaime did not agree, but he was fond of Miguel and admired his courage. Nevertheless, he could not help thinking of him as one of those fatal men possessed by a dangerous idealism and an intransigent purity that color everything they touch with disaster, especially the women who have the misfortune to fall in love with them. He also disliked his ideological position. He was convinced that left-wing extremists like Miguel were doing more to harm the president than those on the right. None of this, however, prevented him from feeling well-disposed toward him or recognizing the strength of his convictions, his natural gaiety, his capacity for tenderness, and the generosity that made him willing to give his life for ideals that Jaime shared but lacked the courage to take to their ultimate conclusion. That night, Jaime slept fitfully and uneasily, uncomfortable in his sleeping bag as he listened to his niece breathing close beside him. When he awoke, she was already up and about and was heating coffee for breakfast. A chill wind was blowing, and the sun lit the mountain peaks with golden reflections. Alba threw her arms around her uncle and gave him a kiss, but he kept his hands in his pockets and did not return the gesture. He was perturbed. Tres Marias was one of the last haciendas in the South to be expropriated under the agrarian reform. The same peasants who had been born there and had farmed the land for generations formed a cooperative and took title to the property. Because it had been 3 years and 5 months since they had last seen their patron, and they had long since forgotten his hurricane-like temper. The foreman, terrified by the turn of events and the fiery tone of the meetings the tenants held in the schoolhouse, gathered up his belongings and disappeared without a word to anyone, not even Senator Trueba, for he did not wish to face his anger, and he felt he had done his duty by warning him many times in the past. With his departure, Tres Marias was left adrift for quite a while. There was no one to give orders, and no one to obey them. The peasants, for the first time in their lives, were savoring the taste of freedom and the experience of being their own patron. They divided up the pasture land, and each grew whatever he wanted, until the government sent an agronomist who gave them seed on credit and brought them up to date on the demands of the market, the difficulties of transporting produce, and the advantages of fertilizers and disinfectants. But the peasants paid him little attention, since he seemed like a city slicker, and it was easy to see that he had never had a plow in his hand. Still, they celebrated his arrival by opening the sacred wine cellar of their former patron, sacking his aged wines and slaughtering his breeding bulls in order to eat their testicles with onion and basil. After the agronomist had left, they also ate the imported cows and all the brood hens. Esteban Trueba discovered that he had lost his land when they notified him that they were going to pay him for it with government bonds that had a 30-year maturation and at the same price he had listed on his tax statement. He lost control. He went to his arsenal, picked up a machine gun he did not know how to use, and, without telling anyone, not even his bodyguards, ordered his chauffeur to drive him straight to Tres Marias. He traveled for many hours, blind with rage and without any clear plan in mind. When they arrived, the chauffeur had to slam on the brakes because a thick wooden beam had been thrown across the gate to the hacienda as a roadblock. One of the tenants was standing guard, armed with a pike and an unloaded shotgun. Trueba got out of the car. When he saw the patron, the poor man frantically rang the schoolhouse bell, which had been hung nearby in case they needed to sound an alarm, and quickly threw himself to the ground. A hail of bullets sailed past his head and embedded themselves in the neighboring trees. Trueba did not stop to see if he was dead. With unusual dexterity for a man his age, he headed down the path to the hacienda without looking to either side, so that the blow to the back of his head took him by surprise and he fell flat on his face in the dust before he even realized what had happened. The next thing he knew, he was in the dining room of the main house, lying face up on the table, his hands tied and a pillow under his head. A woman was pressing moist compresses to his forehead, and gathered around him were almost all his tenants, staring at him with intense curiosity. "How do you feel, compañero?" someone asked. "Sons of bitches! I'm nobody's compañero!" the old man roared, trying to sit up. He struggled and shouted so much that they loosened his bonds and helped him to his feet. But when he attempted to leave, he saw that the windows had been bricked in from outside and that the door was locked. They tried to explain to him that things had changed and that he was no longer the patron, but he refused to listen. He was foaming at the mouth and his heart was about to burst. Cursing like a madman, he threatened them with such punishment and vengeance that they could only respond with laughter. Finally, they grew bored and left him alone, locked in the dining room. Esteban Trueba collapsed into a chair, thoroughly drained from the exertion. Hours later, he was informed that he was now a hostage and that they wanted to film him for television. Alerted by his chauffeur, his two bodyguards and a number of excited young members of the Conservative Party had made the trip to Tres Marias armed with sticks, brass knuckles, and chains, but when they arrived to rescue him, they found a double guard posted at the gate, training the barrel of Senator Trueba's own machine gun on them. "No one's taking our hostage compañero anywhere," one of the peasants said. And in order to emphasize the words, they sent the would-be rescuers packing with a short volley fired into the air. A television truck arrived to film the incident, and the tenants, who had never seen anything like it, let the truck through the gate and posed for the cameras with their broadest smiles, standing around their prisoner. That night, People all around the country saw on their television screens the leader of the opposition tied to a table and foaming at the mouth with rage, bellowing such vile curse words that the tape had to be censored. The president saw it too, and the matter did not amuse him, for he realized it could be the detonator that would set off the powder keg on which his government was delicately perched. He called out the National Guard to rescue the senator. When they reached the ranch, the peasants, emboldened by the support they had received from the press, refused to let them in, demanding a court order. The provincial judge, seeing that he could get himself in a fix and might wind up on national television excoriated by the leftist press, promptly went on a fishing trip. The guardsmen were forced to wait outside the gate of Tres Marias until they received an order from the capital. Blanca and Alba found out, along with everybody else, when they saw it on the news. Blanca waited until the following morning without making any comment, but when she heard that the guardsmen had failed to rescue her father, she decided that the moment had come for her to see Pedro III Garcia again. "Take off those filthy slacks and put on a decent dress," she ordered Alba. They appeared at the ministry without an appointment. A male secretary tried to make them stay in the waiting room, but Blanca pushed him away and proceeded with a firm step, dragging her daughter after her. She opened the door without knocking and burst into Pedro III's office. She had not seen him for 2 years, and she almost turned and left, thinking she had entered the wrong office, because in that short time, the man of her life had grown thin and old. He looked very tired and sad, and even though his hair was still black and shiny, it was thin and short. He had trimmed his beautiful beard and was dressed in a bureaucrat's gray suit and a faded tie of the same color. Only by the look in his old black eyes did Blanca recognize him.
"Jesus, how you've changed," she exclaimed.
To Pedro III, however, Blanca seemed more beautiful than he remembered, as if absence had rejuvenated her. In those 2 years, he had had time to regret his decision and to learn that without Blanca, he had lost his taste for the young girls who had previously attracted him. And when he spent 12 hours a day sitting at a desk, far from his guitar and the inspiration of the people, he had few opportunities to feel happy. The more time passed, the more he missed Blanca's calm, restful love. But the minute he saw her step across the threshold with her determined air, accompanied by Alba, he understood that she had not come to see him for sentimental reasons. He guessed that her visit was prompted by the scandal of Senator Trueba.
"I've come to ask you to accompany us," Blanca said without prefacing her remarks.
"Your daughter and I are going to Tres Marias to rescue the old man." That was how Alba learned that her father was Pedro III Garcia.
"All right, let's stop at my house to pick up my guitar," he replied, already rising from his chair.
They left the ministry in a black car resembling a hearse with official license plates. Blanca and Alba waited in the street while he ran up to his apartment. When he returned, he had recovered some of his old charm. He had changed out of his gray suit into his overalls and poncho of past years. He was wearing sandals and had slung his guitar over his shoulder. Blanca smiled at him for the first time, and he bent down and kissed her quickly on the mouth. The first 60 miles of the trip were spent in silence, until Alba managed to get over her surprise and ask in a quavering voice why they had not told her sooner that Pedro III was her father, and spared her endless nightmares about a count dressed in white who had died of fever in the desert. "Better a dead father than an absent one," Blanca enigmatically replied, and she never mentioned it again. They arrived at Tres Marias at dusk. In front of the gate, they met a large crowd gathered in amiable conversation around a bonfire on which a pig was roasting. It was the guardsmen, the journalists, and the peasants who were finishing off the last of the senator's bottles.
A few dogs and several children were playing in the glow of the flames, waiting for the shiny pink suckling pig to be served. The members of the press recognized Pedro Tercero Garcia immediately because they had interviewed him many times. The guardsmen recognized his unmistakable face as that of the popular singer, and the peasants knew him because they had seen him born on this land. They welcomed him home with great affection. "What brings you here, compañero?" someone asked. "I've come to see the old man," Pedro Tercero said, smiling. "You can go through, compañero, but alone. Doña Blanca and the Señorita Alba will join us in a glass of wine." The two women sat by the fire with the others, and the sweet smell of charred meat reminded them that they had not eaten since that morning. Blanca knew all the tenants and had taught many of them to read in the little schoolhouse of Tres Marias, so they began to talk about the bygone days when the Sanchez brothers imposed their law on the region, when old Pedro Garcia had ended the plague of ants, and when the president had been an eternal candidate standing in the station to harangue them from the train of his defeat. "And to think that one day he would be our president," someone said. "And that one day the patron would have less say at Tres Marias than us," another said, laughing. They led Pedro Tercero Garcia directly into the kitchen. The oldest tenants were standing by the door, guarding the entrance to the dining room where their former patron was being held prisoner. Though they had not seen Pedro Tercero in years, everyone remembered him. They sat down at the table to have a glass of wine and recall the distant past, the days when Pedro Tercero was not a legend in the peasant's memory, but a rebellious boy in love with the daughter of his patron. After that, Pedro Tercero picked up his guitar, rested it on his knee, shut his eyes, and sang with his velvety voice the song about the foxes and the hens. All the old people joined in the refrain. "I'm going to take the patron with me, friends," he said slowly during a pause in the singing. "That's out of the question, son," someone replied. "Tomorrow, the National Guard's going to show up here with a court order and carry him out like a hero," Pedro Tercero said. "It will be better if I take him with me now, with his tail between his legs." They argued for a long while, and finally they led him into the dining room and left him alone with the hostage. It was the first time the two men had been face to face since the fateful day when Trueba had made him pay for his daughter's virginity with an axe. Pedro Tercero remembered him as an angry giant with a snakeskin whip and a silver cane, at whose step the tenants trembled, and whose thunderous voice and feudal arrogance made all of nature quake. He was surprised to find the resentment he had stored up over all these years melt away in the presence of this bent and shrunken old man who was staring up at him in fright. Senator Trueba had exhausted his rage, and the night he had spent tied to a chair had left him with a pain in all his bones and the fatigue of 1,000 years in his back. At first, he had difficulty in recognizing Pedro. But when he saw that he was missing 3 of the fingers on his right hand, he understood that this was the end of the nightmare in which he was immersed. They stared at each other in silence for several seconds, each thinking that the other was the very incarnation of everything most hateful in the world, but unable to find the old fire of hatred in their hearts. "I've come to get you out of here," Pedro Tercero said. "Why?" the old man asked. "Because Blanca asked me to," Pedro Tercero replied. "Go to hell," Trueba said without conviction. "Fine, that's where we're going. You're coming with me." Pedro Tercero proceeded to untie his bonds, which had been wrapped around his wrists to keep him from pounding on the door. Trueba averted his glance to keep from looking at Pedro Tercero's mutilated hand. "Get me out of here without their seeing me. I don't want the journalists to make fun of me," Senator Trueba said.
I'm taking you out the same way you came in, through the gate, Pedro III said, and he started walking. Trueba followed him with his head bowed. His eyes were red, and, for the first time he could remember, he felt defeated. They crossed the kitchen, and still the old man did not look up. They went through the house and followed the path that led from the main building to the outside gate, accompanied by a group of unruly children who skipped along beside them, and an entourage of silent peasants who followed behind. Blanca and Alba were sitting with the journalists and guardsmen, eating roast pig with their fingers and drinking mouthfuls of red wine straight from a bottle that was being passed from hand to hand. When she saw her grandfather, Alba was troubled. She had not seen him so dejected since the day Clara died. Swallowing what was in her mouth, she ran to greet him. They hugged each other tightly, and she whispered something in his ear, which apparently made Senator Trueba regain his dignity, for he raised his head and smiled with his old pride into the lights of the cameras. The journalists filmed him climbing into a black car with official plates, and people wondered for weeks what all the foolishness had been about, until other, far more serious events eclipsed all memory of the incident. That night, the president, who had acquired the habit of outwitting his insomnia by playing chess with Jaime, discussed the matter between two games, while his astute eyes, hidden behind thick lenses and dark frames, scrutinized his friend's face for the least hint of discomfort. But Jaime continued to place his pieces on the board without saying a word.
"Old Trueba's got his balls in the right place," the president said. "He really should be on our side."
"Your move, Señor President," Jaime replied, pointing to the board. In the following months, the situation deteriorated greatly, like a country at war. Spirits ran high, especially among the women of the opposition, who paraded in the streets pounding their empty pans in protest against the shortages in the stores. Half the population hoped to overthrow the government, and the other half defended it, and no one had time to worry about work. One night, Alba was astonished to find the streets in the center of the city dark and almost deserted. Garbage had not been collected all that week, and stray dogs were scavenging among mountains of waste. Telephone poles were covered with posters faded by the winter rains, and every available inch of space was filled with the slogans of the two opposing sides. Half the street lamps had been smashed, and there were no lights on in any of the buildings. The only illumination came from a few sad bonfires fed by newspaper and wooden planks, around which the small groups that stood guard in front of the ministries, the banks, and the offices were warming themselves, taking turns to make sure the gangs of the extreme right that roamed the streets at night did not jump them in the dark. Alba saw a van pull up before one of the public buildings. A group of young men in white helmets piled out, armed with buckets of paints and brushes, and proceeded to cover the walls with light-colored paint. Then they drew huge multicolored doves, butterflies, and bloody flowers, with hand-lettered verses by the poet, and appeals for the people to unite. These were the youth brigades, who thought they could save the revolution with patriotic murals and inflammatory doves. Alba went up to them and pointed to the mural on the other side of the street. It was stained with red paint and contained a single word printed in enormous letters, Jakarta.
"What does that mean, compañero?" she asked one of them.
"I don't know," he replied. And none of them knew why the opposition had painted that Asiatic word on the walls. They had never heard about the piles of corpses in the streets of that distant city. Alba climbed on her bicycle and pedaled home. After the gasoline rationing and the public transport strike, she had unearthed this childhood toy from the basement as her only means of getting around. She was thinking of Miguel, and a dark foreboding gripped her throat. It had been ages since she had gone to class,
and time hung heavy on her hands. The professors had declared an indefinite strike, and the students had taken over all the buildings. Bored with practicing the cello at home, she used the time when she was not sleeping with Miguel, strolling with Miguel, or talking with Miguel, to work at the hospital in the Misericordia district, where she helped her uncle Jaime and a few other doctors who continued to practice there, despite an order from the School of Medicine to stop work so as to sabotage the government. It was a Herculean task. The hallways were piled with patients who had to wait for days, like a moaning herd, to be examined. The orderlies no longer brought supplies.
Jaime would fall asleep with his scalpel in his hand, so busy that he often forgot to eat.
He had lost weight and looked haggard. He was working 18-hour shifts, and when he could finally lie down on his cot, he was often unable to sleep. His mind raced at the thought of all the patients who were waiting for him, the lack of anesthesia, syringes, and cotton, and the realization that even if he could be multiplied by 1,000, it would still not be enough, because it was like trying to stop a train with your bare hands. Amanda also worked in the clinic as a volunteer, both to be close to Jaime and to keep busy. In the exhausting days spent taking care of unknown patients, she regained the light that had illuminated her from within when she was young, and for a time, she had the illusion of being happy. She wore a blue smock and rubber shoes, but when she was around him, Jaime was convinced he heard the tinkle of the glass beads she used to wear. He was glad to have her there, and he wished he loved her. The president appeared on television almost every night to denounce the ruthless war being waged by the opposition. He was very tired, and at times his voice would crack. People said that he was drunk and that he spent his nights in orgies with mulatas flown in from the tropics to warm his bones. He announced that the striking Teamsters were receiving $50 a day from abroad to keep the country at a standstill. People responded that he was being sent coconut ice cream and Soviet arms via diplomatic pouch. He said that his enemies were conspiring with the generals to launch a coup d'etat because they would rather see democracy dead than be governed by him. They accused him of telling paranoid lies and of stealing paintings from the National Museum to hang in his mistress's bedroom. He warned that the right was armed and determined to sell the country to imperialism, and they replied that his pantry was stocked with breasts of fowl while the masses had to stand in line to buy the neck and wings of the same bird. The day Luisa Mora rang the bell of the big house on the corner, Senator Trueba was in his study doing his accounts. She was the last remaining Mora sister. Reduced to the size of a wandering but completely lucid angel, she was in full possession of her indomitable spiritual energy. Trueba had not seen her since Clara's death, but he recognized her by her voice, which still sounded like an enchanted flute, and by her perfume of wild violets, which, although somewhat tempered by time, was still noticeable even at a distance. As she entered the room, she brought with her the winged presence of Clara, floating in the room before the loving eyes of her husband, who had not seen her in several days. "I've come to bring you some bad news, Esteban," Luisa Mora said after she had settled into the armchair. "Ah, dear Luisa, I've had enough of that," he said, sighing. Luisa told him what she had discovered in the stars. She had to explain the scientific method she had used in order to overcome the senator's pragmatic resistance. She told him she had spent the past 10 months studying the astrological charts of each important person in the government and the opposition, including Trueba himself. When she compared the charts, they showed that at this exact historic moment, there would be a terrible sequence of events, bringing blood, pain, and death. "I don't have the slightest doubt about it, Esteban," she concluded. "Terrible times lie ahead. There will be so many dead, they will be impossible to count. You will be on the side of the winners, but victory will only bring you suffering and loneliness. Esteban Trueba felt uneasy in the presence of this unusual soothsayer, who had disturbed the peace of his library, and upset his liver with her astrological rantings. But because of Clara, who was watching him out of the corner of her eye from across the room, he did not have the strength to send her away.
But I didn't come here to upset you with news that's beyond your control, Esteban. I came to speak with Alba, because I have a message for her from her grandmother.
The senator sent for Alba. The girl had not seen Luisa Mora since she was 7, but she remembered her perfectly. She embraced her gently so as not to crush the fragile marble bones and anxiously inhaled a mouthful of her unmistakable perfume.
I came to tell you to be careful, child, Luisa Mora said after she had dried her tears. Death is at your heels. Your grandmother Clara is doing all she can to protect you in the hereafter, but she sent me to tell you that your spiritual protectors are powerless when it comes to major cataclysms. She says it would be wise for you to take a trip, that you should cross the ocean. You'll be safe there.
At this point in the conversation, Esteban Trueba lost his patience. He was convinced he was dealing with a crazed old woman. 10 months and 11 days later, he would recall Luisa Mora's prophetic words when they took Alba away in the middle of the night while the curfew was in force. 13. The Terror. The day of the coup, the sun was shining, a rare event in the timid spring that was just dawning. Jaime had worked practically all night, and by 7 in the morning his body had had only 2 hours of sleep. He was awakened by the ring of the telephone. It was a secretary, her voice slightly agitated, who scared his drowsiness away. She was calling from the presidential palace to inform him that he should present himself there as soon as possible. No, the president was not ill. No, she was not sure what was happening. She had simply been instructed to call all the president's doctors. Jaime dressed like a sleepwalker and got into his car, grateful that his profession entitled him to a weekly ration of gasoline. Otherwise, he would have had to go by bicycle. He arrived at the palace at 8 o'clock and was surprised to see the great square completely empty and a large detachment of soldiers stationed at the gates to the seat of the government. They were in full battle dress, with helmets and guns. Jaime parked his car in the deserted square without noticing the soldiers who were motioning him not to stop. He got out of the car and was immediately surrounded. "What's this, compañeros? Have we gone to war with China?" Jaime smiled. "Keep going. You can't stop here. Traffic is prohibited," an officer ordered. "I'm sorry, but I received a call from the president's office," Jaime said, showing them his identification card. "I'm a doctor." They escorted him to the heavy wooden doors of the presidential palace, where a group of guardsmen were standing watch. They let him through. Inside the building, the commotion resembled that of a shipwreck. Employees were running up and down the stairs like seasick rats, and the president's private guard were pushing furniture against the windows and distributing pistols to those who were closest to him. The president came out to greet him. He was wearing a combat helmet, which looked incongruous with his fine sports clothes and Italian shoes. Then Jaime understood that something momentous was taking place. "The Navy has revolted, Doctor," the president explained tersely. "It's time to fight." Jaime picked up a telephone and called Alba, told her not to leave the house, and asked her to warn Amanda. He never spoke with her again. In the next hour, a few ministers and political leaders arrived, and telephone negotiations with the insurgents were begun in order to gauge the magnitude of the insurrection and to find a peaceful settlement. But by 9:30 in the morning, all the armed units in the country were under the command of officers sympathetic to the coup. In barracks across the country, purges had begun of all those remaining loyal to the Constitution. The commander of the National Guard ordered his men at the palace to leave because the police had just joined the coup. You can go, compañeros, but leave your guns behind, the president said. The guardsmen were confused and ashamed, but the commander's order was final. None of them dared to accept the challenge in the gaze of the chief of state.